Frisch serviert, der Steuerpodcast.
And we're back. Hello everyone. Happy that you're all joining us again for a new episode of our very loved podcast, Freshly Served, Frisch Serviert, today in English, because we have a very dear guest here. Pat Brown is today here as a guest. Hi, Pat.
Arne, nice to see you again. Nice to be with you again.
Absolutely. And we have, as always, Christian with us. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Hanna. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
And as a quick intro, just to let you know who Pat is, as I said, Pat is a dear colleague. He's a partner and co-leader of the PwC Washington National Tax Service Practice. Any kind of policy matters, you're in good hands if it comes to Pat. He was before with Treasury as well from the year 1998 until 2002. Was a long time with GE as well, and since 2019 with PwC. As I said, very much into policy matters, and that's why we invited him today, because tax is on the agenda, not only for us, but also now in a broader sense, if we look to the US, as we have all heard since, I believe it's now we have the 5th of February, so it was last week, I believe, it feels like an eternity ago, where basically very fast at the inauguration, we have a lot of news coming from the US in terms of what potentially could be passed on. We're talking about today two different kind of developments. Actually, it's one development, but coming from two different sides. I don't want to basically too much go into detail already as now, but it's Section 80, 891 and 899. These are the two sections, I believe, which are relevant today, where we talk about taxing also foreign tax citizens. I'll put a bit more neutral. We'll get a bit more deeper what it means technically. But yeah, basically having taxes being levied in a way which we haven't seen so far. And Pat, maybe before I continue and I say more wrong things, is a good chance for you to dive in a little bit and give us an overview. What are those two kind of sections? What are they about? Yeah. What's the whole background? And then we'll dive into the conversation.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Section 891, as you referenced, Arne, has been talked about more over the last 2 weeks than probably the 30 or 40 years before these last 2 weeks. Section 891 has been in the Internal Revenue Code since the 1930s. So it's basically approaching its 100th year anniversary. It has never been invoked. It has never been actually brought into force. It authorizes the president, and it's very unusual in the Internal Revenue Code for there to be any reference specifically to the president. Sometimes you will see in our Internal Revenue Code references to the secretary, meaning the Secretary of the Treasury. And of course, that essentially authorizes the Treasury Department to do things via regulation. But Section 891, again, enacted in the 1930s, the authorization is granted to the president. And what it essentially provides is that when the president makes a determination that foreign countries have been engaged in extraterritorial or discriminatory taxation practices vis-a-vis the United States, the president is authorized to so find, and upon such a finding, there will be a doubling of the rate of tax that's imposed on citizens from those countries and corporations incorporated in those countries. So that is what Section 891 says. Now, interestingly enough, Section 891 is not very lengthy to read. If you Google Section 891 of the Internal Revenue Code, it'll take you 15, 20 seconds to read through it. It's only a couple sentences. There are no regulations under it. This is, again, a statute from the 1930s. So as a practical matter, there's no legislative history to sort of refer to as a guide. There are no definitions provided for what's an extraterritorial tax, what's a discriminatory tax, and literally it just sits there. The reason it has become so relevant over the course of the last 2 weeks is because President Trump, in one of his day one executive actions, he authorized the Secretary of the Treasury, along with the United States Trade Representative and the Secretary of Commerce, to essentially go off and do an analysis of whether or not other countries are engaged in extraterritorial or discriminatory taxation practices vis-a-vis the United States. And that executive order specifically mentions the potential for the application of Section 891. So in a nutshell, that's what Section 891 is. Now I'm going to turn very quickly to Section 899, but I know we want to get into more detail around both of these things. Section 899 is not in the Internal Revenue Code today. Section 899, rather, is a proposed change to the Internal Revenue Code. It was first brought forward by congressional Republicans in May of 2023. So May of 2023, and you all on the European side of the ocean may actually recall that shortly after this legislation was introduced, there was a delegation of congressional Republicans that actually traveled to Europe. They had meetings in Paris, they had meetings in Berlin, basically to express their dissatisfaction with the OECD's Pillar 2 process in particular. That was really the focus of those meetings going back now again in the summer of 2023. But before they actually went on that delegation, those members of Congress, they introduced this Section 899. Section 899 also authorizes an increase in taxation imposed by the United States on corporations and individuals from foreign countries that are engaged in extraterritorial taxation or discriminatory taxation. Now, one of the things that's interesting is, so of course, that's the same turn of phrase that's used in Section 891. Section 899 actually provides a definition of what is an extraterritorial tax and what is considered a discriminatory tax. Again, I want to emphasize, Arna, this has not been enacted. This was originally proposed in May of 2023, was just re-proposed essentially within a couple days of President Trump taking the oath of office and issuing his executive orders referring to Section 891. Congressional Republicans reintroduced this Section 899 along with a press release essentially saying, we support the president's approach here and we are introducing this Section 899, which authorizes an increase in tax, not a doubling to be sure, but an increase in tax on corporations from foreign countries that are engaged in extraterritorial or discriminatory taxation measures. As I mentioned, Section 899 actually provides a definition of each of those things, which I'm sure we're going to get into. How much that definition would inform the meaning of those terms in Section 891? Well, okay, we may find out, but for right now, we don't know.
Yeah, that's a very nice overview, and thanks for explaining the wonderful world of U.S. code sections to us. I guess this is a new standard for determining how old a code section is. If you can read it in a couple of seconds, apparently it's from the 30s. If it takes half a minute to a minute, then it's 40s to 50s, and so on goes. And these days, yes, you can read forever and you don't understand it.
Exactly.
But coming slightly back to the mechanism before we then might go into the definition of what is discriminatory in terms of those sections. If I look at the treaty situation, in essence and practically, we are speaking mostly about then U.S. source income where there would be a withholding on. So it's dividends, interest, royalties, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's other stuff. But okay, I mean, I think this is the focus of that. Under treaties, from a German perspective, the German-US treaty on dividends, zero withholding, right? Zero withholding on interest and also on royalties. So do these sections also include a treaty override?
Yeah.
Great
question, Christian. And frankly, this is, of course, one of the many things where the short answer to the question will be, I don't know. But I'll give a longer answer so we provide some additional guidance to your listeners. So, of course, under U.S. law, and I'm sure this is well known to the listeners, you know, we have what we call a later in time system, right? So treaties don't have primacy over the Internal Revenue Code or any other congressional enactment, and nor vice versa, right? Whichever one is later in time enacted is the one that would take precedence. So to your point, Christian, if you look at Section 891, Section 891 was enacted in the 1930s. It's never been amended. And so, you know, every single bilateral tax treaty that the United States has, literally every single one, has entered into force after Section 891 was enacted. And so you just look at Section 891 and you read it and you say, well, okay, it doubles the rate of tax. Well, to your point, Christian, if I look at the German treaty and I say, well, the relevant rate of tax is zero, if I double zero, it's still zero. One of the things that we will be looking for, of course, is when these reports come back that President Trump has authorized or sort of directed Treasury, Commerce, and USTR to produce these reports. Presumably they will come back, and I would expect that one of the things that might be addressed in these reports is what is the potential interaction of Section 891 with our treaty obligations. I think just as a, and this is just to be clear, just my own view, if you just pick up Section 891 and you say, okay, well, does this apply notwithstanding treaty obligations, given what I said about later in time being the general rule under U.S. law, you would say, well, no, actually it doesn't. That is to say, the treaties would take precedence because they are later in time than Section 891. And of course, the action by the president to actually invoke Section 891 does not have the effect as a legal matter of making it later in time, right? It doesn't change the fact that it's actually a 1930s vintage provision. So you wouldn't expect that would cause a change to that basic question. Now, Section 899, of course, which, as I mentioned, has not yet been enacted, very much on the table to be enacted because, of course, Republicans control both houses of Congress and President Trump as a Republican in the White House. If that provision gets enacted, one would expect sort of the opposite. Okay, well, that's later in time than any of our existing treaties. And indeed, when the congressional Republicans reintroduced Section 899 over the course of the last week or so, they actually made very few changes to the statutory text from the original introduction in May of 2023. But they did make one change. One change that they made was they added language to the reintroduced bill to make it explicit that it would override treaties. Now, again, I don't think that language is technically necessary as a matter of U.S. law because if the statutory provision is later in time, but I think for purposes of sort of having the, you know, whether you want to call it saber rattling or getting the attention of folks from other countries around this stuff, it seems as though the congressional Republicans may have wanted to make it clear, and we intend this to apply, notwithstanding that you may be in a treaty country.
That's interesting. And actually also now, looking how it applies, assuming it overrides the treaty, both kind of provisions, otherwise 891, we could forget it potentially in regard, right, at least to Germany. I understand it correctly, if they will be introduced, they could basically work together. So right now we have a 30% rate basically on interest and dividend, as we said. So any kind of payments going out from the US to Germany, you would basically have this doubling, which is from 30 to 60, which is quite a bit. Then adding another five, first year, second year, another five, basically. I believe 891 goes to the maximum of 80%. I believe that's it, right. Also doubles every year, if I'm not mistaken. So probably 30, 60, and then to 80, I guess. And then five on top. Nothing left,
again,
I would say.
I mean, one can obviously speculate, not to say that there's not some, you know, level of kind of, wow, you know, lots of different ways to potentially think about this. I mean, we can let our imaginations run wild. The answer, again, is we just don't know. So when we get this report from the Secretary of the Treasury, from USTR, from Commerce, mm-hmm, you know, we may very well get some guidance in the around how the departments would think of the question of, and how does Section 891 apply, one, generally speaking, with respect to treaties, but two, how does it apply potentially in concert with other provisions that might also affect the rate of tax that is imposed by the United States on a country. One other thing that I should mention, and I didn't mention it previously, but I think it is of interest to the listening audience, Section 891 and Section 899 differ in one other potentially significant respect. So Section 891 applies to citizens of foreign countries and corporations incorporated in foreign countries that have adopted extraterritorial or discriminatory taxes. Now, notice what I said there, citizens of foreign countries. That's in Section 891. That's the 100-year-old provision that's never been invoked, right? Well, if you're actually, let's say, a German citizen and you're living and working in the United States, let's say you're the CEO of a U.S. company, and for that reason, you're living and working in the United States, you're still a German citizen. You might even be a dual German-U.S. citizen, but you're still a German citizen. And so literally, the way Section 891 is written, that doubling of tax potentially applies to you. Interestingly enough, if you're a U.S. multinational and you have a CFC, a foreign subsidiary that's in Germany, well, that's a German corporation. Notwithstanding that it's owned by a U.S. parent, it's still a German corporation. So under Section 891, this doubling of tax potentially applies in that context as well. Now, again, obviously, Arnie, to your point, and Christian, your point, the treaty question overhangs all of this, right?
Sure.
But if we put that to the side for the moment, and you just ask the question, how would this apply without regard to treaty obligations, you would say, well, if you're a citizen of Germany working in the U.S., that could be an issue. Likewise, if you're the CFC of a U.S. parent, that could be an issue. Section 899, again, not yet enacted, proposed, actually would look to address both of those things, because Section 899 says the provision would not apply to someone who is a resident of the United States. So if you're residing in the United States, or if you're a citizen of the United States, so again, dual citizens would get protection, And similarly, Section 899 says it would not apply to CFCs of U.S. companies, to foreign affiliates of U.S. companies. And so you can see how Section 891, again, from the 1930s, not a lot of detail around it, very blunt. Section 899, sort of some very similar concepts built into it, but more sophisticated, to your point, Christian, a lot longer read too, but more sophisticated maybe in its approach in terms of how it wants to determine how where this tax applies.
Yeah. Christian was signaling me he wants to actually certainly want to say something. I just want to say, Christian, your secondment now to the yes must be canceled, you know, if you want to work now. And
I had the pleasure that I was seconded in the years 2007 and 8, and the code sections already had been long, yeah, but nobody was talking about 891 and other stuff these days. But actually, I mean, the 891 scenario, that's a real nightmare scenario. That's a nightmare. But even without 891, the mere 899, yeah, so 30% plus 5 percentage points on top, 35 the first year, and then it goes up every following year until it reaches 50. I mean, withholding on interest, royalties, and dividends. The German Ministry of Economy, and I think it's also environment and stuff, they issued a report just recently that the German outbound, inbound into the US direct investment is $619 billion US dollars. And well, that's a number, right? And if you assume that there's a 5% profitability, that's not too much for investment. So you would have a profitability of $31 billion a year. And at some point in time, you have to get that, right? I mean, it's a dividend or it's an interest. There has to be a way that this profit flows to the German investor. And then you would have a 35% withholding in the first year, which is $11 billion. And if you compare that to our German corporate tax income the funds that the governments receive from the corporate tax, that in 23 had been 44 billion euro. So it's a quarter of the overall German income from corporate taxes, which is at risk. I mean, this is really something. So I believe it would be nice now to look into what are the triggers for 899. So what is that is seen as extraterritorial and discriminatory?
Yeah. Thanks, Christian. Great question. So these turns of phrase or these terminology, extraterritorial, discriminatory taxation, not defined in Section 891. Congress now, or the Republicans in Congress, have said, you know, we're going to use these similar concepts, these similar terminology in our proposed Section 899, but we're going to provide definitions. And the definitions are very instructive and very helpful in terms of figuring out what is the focus of the Republicans' anger or dissatisfaction. So the definition of extraterritorial taxation, I'm not going to read it to the audience, but the definition of extraterritorial taxation quite clearly focuses on the Pillar 2 UTPR and exclusively the Pillar 2 UTPR. To my knowledge, there is no other tax on planet Earth that meets the definition of extraterritorial tax as defined in Section 899 other than the Pillar 2 UTPR. And I want to make a point of emphasizing it's not the Pillar 2 IIR. It's not QDMTTs. It is very specifically written at and targeted at the UTPR. So that's what they mean when they write the definition of extraterritorial. And I can tell you from conversations I've had with the staff who worked on the bill, they also wanted to be clear that that's the intended target. And in fact, some of the input they have been seeking from folks is, we're not getting any other taxes, right? Because extraterritorial, we want to make sure that's the UTPR. That's the focus of what they're trying to get is the UTPR. Discriminatory taxation is, frankly, it's a little bit of a squishier definition. Intended target of discriminatory taxation is digital services taxes, right? And of course, we haven't spoken at all yet about Pillar 1 and the OECD project around Pillar 1, which seems to be obviously languishing. But it has long been a point of frustration, anger, frankly, from both congressional Democrats and Republicans, that digital services taxes appear to be targeting U.S. companies, et cetera, et cetera. And so the definition of discriminatory taxation in Section 899 is intended to be focused on digital services taxes. Now, why is it a little bit squishier? Well, because there's not just one type of digital service tax out there. And there are, you know, when people refer to digital services taxes, including the OECD, they refer to digital services taxes and other similar measures, right? And we've seen that kind of terminology used by the OECD, by the US. So it's a more amorphous target to aim at. And so the definition is a little bit squishier. Now, one of the things that that does mean is if you read the definition of discriminatory taxation, you can find taxes that exist on planet Earth that we would all agree are not digital services taxes, but are potentially within the meaning, within the scope and the meaning of that definition of discriminatory tax. So I think there is probably some more work to be done to try and narrow down the definition of discriminatory tax that's in Section 899. One change, by the way, that was made, I mentioned the one change that was made between the original introduction of Section 899 and its reintroduction. Of course, that one change I mentioned already was to add explicit language overriding treaties. But there was another change that was made in the reintroduction of Section 899, and that was to say explicitly that real and personal property taxes are not considered discriminatory taxes, because the original definition in Section 899, if you just read through it, you would say, well, every single U.S. state has discriminatory taxes because they all have real property taxes. And presumably many, many countries, you know, would fit into the definition of having discriminatory taxes and thereby be exposed to Section 899 because they have real property taxes or personal property taxes. So Congress, I think, had received that feedback and then revised the definition. Again, I still think there's more work to be done to kind of refine that definition of discriminatory taxation, assuming the target is DSTs, and I believe the target is DSTs. But there's clearly more to be done there, I would say.
Mm. Pat, I have a few follow-up questions. That's very mm-hmm. helpful. Thank you so much. So actually, I think it's three questions.
Okay.
So I'm trying to get them out here. So the one question is that it might be a bit from a German angle. You, of course, are very much aware of the discussion about our Section 49 income tax app. So for right. our listeners, it's the question to what extent if you have IP payments with registered IP, to what extent they are taxable in Germany. And it's been a long ongoing topic, basically, of debate, I would think, also between US and Germany. And as I understand, there were also some discussions on a higher political level with regard to the section, which, by the way, has been softened in the meantime. So now yeah. I think in the US context, it's less of a topic. One question would be, is Section 49 also something to fully abolish it, where people say this is not enough and it's to be fully gone? That's my one question, whether it's beside the UTPR, one item which sometimes you're hearing still those conversations. And with regard to the UTPR, I mean, I also want to ask, well, we have the safe harbor, basically, through the UTPR. And as long as the US tax rate doesn't change, it's basically exempt. So I would think, actually, it should be okay in that sense, because we're not taxing US. Is it enough, or is a safe harbor not enough? Anything around that? And the third question is basically, the UTPR safe harbor is only, of course, with regard to constituted entities which are meeting the threshold, which, let's say, in the current situation with the current tax rate, US in a lot of cases would be outside of scope. Of course, right. then there might be certain situations with tax credits. We can talk about that as well, whether this is something, if it lowers the tax rate, that we're still subject to the safe harbor. But the other question is also, was it if there's any subsidiaries involved from the US where the UTPR safe harbor would not apply, basically? Is right. this also something kind of seeing as an extension, basically, of, let's say, taxing US territorial profits? I mean, technically, yeah. I would say the answer is no. So these are like the three things. I don't know whether you can help us to basically yeah. maneuver through them.
So, I mean, the first question first, I don't think the Section 49 is, to be clear, it's your point is a good one, Arna. Your version of Section 891, a 100-year-old statutory provision that's, you know, sort of been sitting there and then suddenly it gets this very different understanding and gets applied in a way differently than we all thought. So, you know, there are arguably some parallels there. I don't think it would fall into the definition of extraterritorial taxation. Again, that's really the UTPR and intended to be only the UTPR. I'd have to give a little bit more thought as to whether or not it could meet that definition of discriminatory. On first blush, my guess, I know it wasn't the intended target, but again, because that definition is sort of squishy, query whether or not, you know, if you read it, you might say, well, you know, I can see how somebody might interpret it that way. Definitely not the intended target. I do think that the rhetoric around Section 49 in the United States has really diminished from where it was. Obviously, as you noted, there have been changes in Germany with respect to it. And so I think that's been helpful. I also think there's been sort of just frankly, there's a lot going on, right? And so perhaps people's attention has turned away from it. It did, Section 49, get to the level of politicians in the United States, elected representatives in the Congress, sort of expressing dissatisfaction and concern about it. I mean, to be sure, 2% of the temperature that we see with respect to the OECD's UTPR and DSTs. You know, Section 49 issue is, you know, barely a rounding error, if you want to, you know, think about it in those terms, in terms of the level of frustration and anger. And so, you know, just not in the same league with the UTPR and DSTs. On the question, you ask a really good question, a really important one about, okay, well, we've got the UTPR safe harbor. Isn't that going to be sufficient? Obviously, it's a transitional safe harbor, but what if we just roll back forward? It's important to note, and this, again, I should have mentioned this, but the way Section 899 is written, it is not brought into force, or you don't meet the definition of extraterritorial taxation only based on the UTPR applying it to the U.S. income of U.S. companies. It's the UTPR. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when congressional Republicans have talked about Section 899, they have not talked about it as exclusively limited to, they have used the application of the UTPR on the U.S. income of U.S. companies as their example, the bloody shirt, if you will, that they wave. You know, it's offensive that we can't provide the U.S. R&D credit, or our FDII regime is targeted, or if President Trump wants to introduce a reduced rate on domestic manufacturing, he can't do it because of the UTPR. That's the way a lot of them talk about it. If you read Section 899, the focus is the UTPR applied anywhere, any country. Mm-hmm. And so in conversations with offices who have worked on this legislation, if you ask the question, is that a mistake? Are you guys really just focused on the UTPR in the U.S.? The answer is no. We're focused on the UTPR. The UTPR mm-hmm. is the problem. Because what they find troublesome about that is this, let's call it, novel taxing mechanism, right? The idea that countries are asserting tax on income that is outside their borders, where the taxing entity has no ownership interest. Again, just very much distinguishing in their minds from QDMTTs or IIRs. That is really the focus of their dissatisfaction, their ire. So as a starting point, some of the questions that I have gotten since we saw Section 899 reintroduced was, well, isn't the answer to this simple? We'll just roll forward the UTPR safe harbor. And the answer is not so fast, because that actually won't do it, because the conceptual framework of the UTPR applied anywhere in the world, that is the problem. Now, that gives rise to a different question, though, Arne, which is, you know, if you went to the next level and said, well, what if we said our U.S. GILTI regime was a good IIR, and we said we would take the UTPR safe harbor and rolled that forward indefinitely? Those two changes taken together would, at least for U.S. multinationals, say essentially the UTPR really doesn't exist. It doesn't apply outside the United States because our GILTI would be a good IIR, and it doesn't apply inside the United States because we would have UTPR safe harbor. And the answer to that question is, at least under the terms of the legislation as proposed, as drafted, that still wouldn't be sufficient, because it triggers off of a country having a UTPR on its books. But if you ask members of Congress who are behind this, if you said, look, if the UTPR existed as a concept, it could just never apply to any U.S. company, how would you feel about that? The answer is, we don't know, because that question hasn't been posed to them in those terms. So that's one of the things to watch in this space as well, is the desire to really pull the UTPR out by its roots conceptually, or simply to turn off the application of the UTPR in the case of U.S. companies.
Yeah. So it would be basically, if we narrow down the UTPR, if a section never applied, it would be the Section 891 of Germany, so to speak, a provision which should be never applied. So
isn't it nice? I'll do it now the same way Arne is doing it. I wrote down 6 questions.
Oh my God.
You know, wow. We always have a competition, and Arne's new approach is that he's firing out 3 questions at once, and that leaves no time at the end. No, I'm joking.
Okay.
But I think it's a very relevant question that just came to my mind. I was participating in a couple of discussions, and in those discussions, I mean, already a week ago, I had not had the extreme clear picture that 2025, if that law would be enacted, 2025 would already be totally in focus. If I listen to you, that's the case because the transitional UTPR safe harbor doesn't help. Right. So without any change outside of the US, we would be in. So my question is, I have two questions actually. So how do you see the likelihood of that legislation be passed? Maybe with some changes, not exactly, but be passed in principle. First question, and would it then apply to dividends, interest, and royalties that already had been paid in the calendar year 2025, but before the enactment of this new law, this Section 899? And there might even be a little bit of a bifurcation there, because it could be a payment before, I think it was reintroduced. When was it reintroduced? Before the date of the draft, and after the day of the draft.
Yeah. So anybody who's done U.S. tax policy as long as I have knows that it's dangerous to speculate on the likelihood of a particular piece of legislation getting actually across the finish line and becoming law. So I think it's, but it's a significant risk, Christian, that this gets enacted in some form. Yes, possibly with some changes, but I think I would probably just want to emphasize here, if you talk to the people behind this legislation, they would say, we don't actually want this legislation to apply. We want this legislation as a demonstration that we are serious in the United States. We in the Congress support President Trump's agenda. We're serious in the United States that we want to see these changes to Pillar Two. But, you know, in their minds, that would be, and it's not sufficient for us to just propose legislation and leave it sitting there. We think we probably need to go ahead and enact it. So I think there's a really significant risk that happens. Is it an 80% chance? Is it a, you know, 60% chance? It's meaningful. It's meaningful. And so it's not sort of an academic exercise to think about this. I think that's an important point. It would be, in my view, extremely unlikely. I don't want to say it's zero chance, but a very, very low probability that there would be any retroactive application of this. It's just not the way Congress typically operates in this space. And typically where they do things like this, this would be done through a reconciliation bill. The effective dates would essentially kick in at the start of the next year. So it would be January 1st, 2026. So it would be extremely unusual for them to attempt to do this on a retroactive basis. And I would say even more so in this case, because again, if you listen to what they're saying is, we don't want this to apply at all. We want this to be essentially a mechanism to push other countries to take action. Well, if you're going to apply it retroactively, you know, you can't take action for something that's already in a time period that's already passed. So I would be really surprised to see anything like this with any kind of retroactive effect.
And I see that Arne now is getting nervous, but just for clarification purposes, because for our mostly German listeners, we have two types of retroactivity. One is the true and the untrue is a bad translation. So for a law enacted in 2025, under German constitutional law, it would be okay and acceptable if it applies from January 1st, 25. But if I listen to you, that's different in the States. So if it's enacted in 2025, it wouldn't even go back to January 1st of 2025, it would most likely be applied then after the enactment, most likely January 1st, 2026.
Yes.
Correct? Okay.
Yes. But just to be clear, on Section 891, if it were to apply and the treaty wouldn't help, if I'm not mistaken, that could be applicable from 2025 onwards, right? Because that is something which wouldn't go through the normal procedure of passing law. And so that.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, yes. But again, I think Section 8, obviously, we have a lot more questions about Section 891 than we do answers. So I think for the best we can do with Section 891 is let's see what the executive, what the report is that goes to the president from these executive agencies as to how they think Section 891 would apply and in what circumstances it would apply to give us guidance. I again would be surprised, Arne, even if it's theoretically available as an option, to say, well, we're going to do it, you know, going back in time effectively with respect to a payment that potentially has already happened. Yeah. I think that would be surprising.
Yeah, but at least it means for the German folks out there, even watch also 2025, the development, because if it were to be acted within 25, payments in 25 could be caught basically. So yeah, might be earlier. I'm also hearing from a German side sometimes considerations, well, companies might adjust, you know, basically if you have a branch, you can make the change the branch into a subsidiary, I guess you call it incorporation, you know, you might just prevent paying out dividends so far, even though sometimes, as Christian said, you might need the dividends from a cash perspective. perspective, but leaving that aside, the question is also, of course, well, what happens? And that's something you hear sometimes. Companies might just interpose another more friendly territory and channel the dividends and interest over it. I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a little bit too easy to think along this way, I suppose, no? I mean, you guys have also some kind of anti-abuse provisions, I suppose. I mean, maybe not in the law, but general concepts. I don't know.
We do. And I mean, by the way, you know, the United States system is awash in various types of anti-abuse provisions, of course. But to your point, Arno, there are specific rules targeting what we would call that, what you just described would be sort of a conduit type approach. And we have specific rules, you know, anti-conduit regulations authorized by Congress, regulations on the books. Those could easily be amended if necessary to ensure that their scope would cover things like this. But I also think, you know, to use a U.S. expression, you know, it's not falling off a log to change your dividend payments or the way your royalties are structured or things like this. Sure. So, I mean, the application of these things, I think, is something that would hit and would likely hurt. And I think that's what, you know, companies would have to expect. Yeah. And then again, the question is, if you view this from the perspective of the ultimate goal of the exercise is not to actually collect these taxes, but to actually force the conversation around what would the United States like to see in terms of changes to Pillar 2?
Yeah, we're almost actually getting into the hour. I don't know, Christian, whether you have another thing on, you want on tariffs, I think you want to talk about also brief. But
on tariffs, I mean, the good thing is that we are all no customs experts, even though I'm responsible for it, so I shouldn't say that publicly. but for me, I mean, there's a little bit of an interplay between what Trump and the executive is doing on tax and on the other side on tariffs, because we heard Trump say that, I mean, personal income tax should be abolished because the U.S. can be funded via customs. What I don't understand a little bit, if you want to make the country attractive, then this 899 and 891 is certainly the wrong direction, right? So people would be encouraged to invest in the U.S. to avoid customs and have a local value add. But on the other side, if you are an inbound investor, then all of a sudden you have this 891 and 899 threat. So that doesn't really go together.
Great point. I'd say two separate points there. One is, to what extent is, you know, the tariff policy or conversations about trade policy intermingled with tax policy conversations? And I think certainly in the president's mind, very much intermingled, very much intermingled. You know, and of course, as we've just seen over the last several days, President Trump believes that tariffs can be an effective negotiating tactic to, you know, we're going to impose tariffs because we're dissatisfied with respect to the behavior of particular countries in particular contexts. We've seen that again in the last few days with Canada and Mexico. Get concessions from them or more attention to an issue or whatever it is. Okay, fine, let's put it at bay. So the idea of using these kinds of, I'm going to just call it threats, of increased taxation or increased tariffs as a mechanism to goad changes in behavior clearly fits within the worldview of President Trump and the current administration. You raise a really interesting point, though, Christian, which I want to make sure we don't lose sight of, and that is the United States benefits enormously from inbound investment from non-U.S. headquartered multinationals. Enormously. I mean, you just have to, you know, drive around the American South and see all the facilities that have been built over the course of the last 20 or 30 years by foreign headquartered multinationals in places like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, et cetera, South Carolina. You know, these places are very staunchly Republican in their worldview for the most part. And yet they are benefiting enormously from inbound investment from non-U.S. Multinationals. So even the members of Congress who want to see a very muscular response from the United States with respect to Pillar 2, it is not lost on these members that their constituents, the citizens in their districts and their states, are highly dependent on the, you know, continued presence of investment from non-U.S. multinationals here in the United States. And so there is that tension playing out. It's not playing out publicly right now. Right. We're not seeing members of Congress who support this legislation saying, well, I have real misgivings about it because of the potential effect on investment in my state or in my district. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact it's very clearly there. They are very clearly aware of that fact. And that is why it doesn't take very long before these in these conversations before they will say, we don't want these retaliatory taxes to apply at all. We just want to get to a better place. And yep. we need the world to see that we're serious. The point you make about inbound investment in the United States and the importance of maintaining the U.S. as an attractive place for inbound investment, it's not just sort of an academic point that, you know, economists would talk about. Members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, from the states that really are some of the staunchest supporters of this stuff, they recognize that same point as well. So it's a really important point for our listeners to understand.
Mm-hmm. Pat, that's great. I'm hearing actually from our production team here that we're already with 40 minutes. As you can see, usually we take 30 minutes, but this is the topic is a difficult one, but this conversation is an easy one. That's why we actually keep a little bit longer. So thanks for basically coming up. I think for us to close, I mean, Christian, I think, and Pat, we certainly all hope that basically those topics will be somehow resolved, even though right now it sounds there's still, let's say, pressure, I would say. Also, Christian, you said just before we just came together here that from a European side, I haven't even seen there was a reaction which was not so positive. I don't know whether you want to share it.
European Union Parliament, which, I mean, that's a good thing, doesn't have too much to say within tax. But the chairman of the subcommittee on tax, Pasquale Tridico, he said, well, We shouldn't back up here. We have to hold our stand, and we owe this to the citizens and companies of the European Union, which actually I don't see. So I would rather want them to adjust so that these retaliatory measures don't kick in. But that's the statement.
Let's see how this all resolves. We will see. We will certainly basically follow it. And I think it's also important, just as a last point, if those taxes were to be applied, also for Germany, for German companies, would really have an effect, because under the current situation, unless we change the law, we would not be even able to properly credit it, basically, because these are taxes which are actually not even levied according to the treaty. So under German domestic law, unless, of course, the German legislator changes the law, it would be a real double taxation on a fairly high rate. So that would be certainly a problem. And as you know, we're right now also in the election process. So for us, changing the law is also not that easy. So therefore, this is certainly something which is, I think, a critical measure. So we will certainly have a look on that. And Pat, if we have new developments, if you are basically, of course, saying it's a nice show, you come back, we will certainly invite you again.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you both. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Take care.
Frisch serviert, der Steuerpodcast, powered by CH Beck.